doesn't see himself or herself as worth it, would actually be arrogant, put other people down.
I do have a question over here, but if you allow, we'll go for a short break and we return. And
sure.
Please stay tuned, dear listeners.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to Islamic upbringing. We're talking about Islamic upbringing, of course. So, brother, I had a question. You remember you said in one of the programs that the child with confidence, he does not need approval, right? And even if you praise them, they'll be like, all right, fine, thank you. But doesn't that like sort of go around the lines of arrogance that is a sign of not being confident?
Right. So arrogance is a good question. So arrogance is when you put other people down, right? Arrogance is to say, I am better than others, okay? This is very different from not needing other people's praise, right? If I have enough confidence in me, and this confidence is in a way that is, I know my worth, I know my skills, I know my ability, and I also know my limits as well. A person who has confidence will also understand that I have limits as well. I'm able to do certain things, I'm not able to do certain things. So praise,
right, they're realistic, you mean?
Exactly, they're realistic. So when you praise them, it's not that they put it over and say, oh, I am greater than what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's not saying that. It's rather saying that this doesn't have impact on my motivation. It's not going to make me do things because you praise me. I knew what I am. I know my worth. I know how much I can do. I know how much I can't do.
And I'll keep on doing it besides.
Exactly. I'm driven by something other than your praise.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah.
Arrogant people are driven because they don't have this self-worth. They always count themselves as unworthy or lacking something, or
hence pushing down other people, putting
exactly.
them down.
They okay. feel that they need to put other people down so that they can actually have some sort of worth.
Right.
We have in our traditions, for instance, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in his report, he says that قَالَ مَا مِن رَجُلٍ تَكَبَّرَ أَوْ تَجَبَّرَ إِلَّا لِذِلَّةٍ وَجَدَهَا فِي نَفْسِهِ.
Right.
It's a very powerful sentence from the sixth holy Imam. He says that you won't find a person who does takabbur, who portrays arrogance, or tajabbara, counts himself as greater, wants to put himself forward as bigger than others.
Right.
Except that they found within themselves a dhillah, that they saw within their own self a lack, unworthiness. Right.
So there's a sense of inferiority within them.
Exactly. When they count themselves as inferior than others, they feel that I need to put others lower than me so that I can have some sort of
superiority.
Exactly.
Yeah, imaginary superiority.
Rather, a person with iman, with trust, with confidence in themselves, with an awareness of their own worth, they give a lot of respect to others. They give a lot of esteem to others because they don't need to put other people down to find their own self. They already know how much they're worth, and they already have enough confidence in themselves. And actually, because of this, it leads them to respect others more, to give other people a helping hand, to show respect.
Help them grow. Help other people grow.
Exactly. They work together. They're more likely to work together. They're more likely to be part of a team. They have this humility within themselves because they know their own place. They all know how much beneficial they are they know that I need others as well, to as we need to grow
together.
Yeah,
social human beings are social after all. Yeah,
exactly. So, as a sign, and you can see this in children as well, as one of the signs of confidence and lack of how much respect they give to others, how much they don't necessarily need to compare themselves with others. Or put others down that I'm better than this
themselves
person.
To feel better.
Exactly.
Sorry, I kept you with my question from moving on with the topic, and it's time for another break. So please stay tuned and we'll be back after a short break.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're here with Brother Miqdad discussing the signs of confidence and the lack of. Brother, you talked about children putting other people down, and well, you mentioned the tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that addresses everyone, not just children, putting people down because they feel inferior. You had another point, I guess.
Right. Before we move on, I guess, because we've got one last part of the show left, maybe we can talk about one or two more signs and then move on, inshallah, in the next session. One other thing that's very interesting is people who, now adults more, or children as well, who have a lack of confidence would actually have more desire for this world, for mundane things, right?
Right.
Let me put it this way. The world is something that gives us a very temporary amount of pleasure, a very temporary amount of perfection, right? The pleasure that we receive from this world is very short, sometimes a couple of minutes, a couple of hours, and it just goes on. And it usually has a lot of pain with it as well, right? A lot of efforts. A person who doesn't have enough confidence, they actually satisfy themselves with things that are very very shallow, very lowly, basically, because they don't have enough worth. I'm not worth anything. I'm a failure.
Okay.
And
okay.
Therefore, they would be like, I'll be satisfied with
things. With whatever I have, you know.
Exactly.
I'm good. Like,
and the dunya is like this. The desires of this world are like this.
So that's different from being content with what you have. That's doing with the less that you have.
Exactly.
Not,
yeah.
You know, right.
So
okay.
This is not contentment. This is actually going for things that are very low pleasures, basically.
Because you're undervaluing yourself.
Exactly. And it all comes back to understanding your worth. So children or adults who have confidence, they realize that actually I'm worth more than this, right? It comes back to the fact that I understand that I'm a being that Allah has created for something much greater than just this world. If I look at myself, if I understand my worth, I realize that Allah has created me for knowledge that is of much greater worth, of power that is much greater worth. For obedience of Allah, which is the source of all perfection for the human being. And these are concepts, these are perfections, these are stations that are very high for a human being. Now these would only become a goal or an objective for a person who counts himself as important enough or worthy enough to reach those goals.
Within themselves, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and this is why, for example, you have that in Tuhaful Uqul, we have that the Imam says, "Man karumat alayhi nafsu hanat alayhi dunya." One who counts themselves as having worth or value, they would actually not give any importance to the world.
Yeah,
right? They would count themselves very low. You're not worth enough. Like, I'm too great for you, basically.
Right,
I'm bigger than this small fame or worldly material pleasures and all kind of thing. I'm greater than all of this.
So
right?
Yeah, unimportant. So it becomes unimportant, and they become needless of the temporary world because they've valued themselves correctly.
Exactly.
Yeah,
they see that their goal in life and their goal of creation much greater than these small things.
So I think that's the best. That's the best option to end our program with a tradition, also very meaningful. Food for thought. Please allow us to leave for now and join you with another episode. Please do send us your suggestions, questions, and comments on englishradio@irib.ir, and also do visit our website, parstoday.com, parstoday.com. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Round the world with reporters.
Highlighting the low capability of NATO troops to bring calm to Afghanistan, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson recently has said that NATO must be realistic about the issue. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson also said it would take combined efforts of many nations, including Afghanistan's neighbors, to help the Afghan people to build their future. This comes as the White House recently welcomed Iran's move to host the first round of intra-Afghan talks in Tehran. The recent remarks by the UK Prime Minister highlight an Afghan proverb saying only neighbors remain for each other, not others. Afghan officials have also realized that the best way to bring calm to Afghanistan is to boost the ties between neighboring countries and the entire region.
This is a true illustration of our conviction that Afghanistan is an integral part of Central Asia and that we have common challenges and collective responsibility to work together to address them.
As a matter of fact, most of Afghanistan's neighboring countries have so far played a key role in bringing peace to the war-ravaged country, excluding Pakistan. This is because Afghan officials have always blamed Islamabad for destabilizing Afghanistan by backing terrorism.
Pakistan is not only after the revival of Taliban regime, but it also follows other goals by backing terrorism, including creating border tensions and competing with India in our soil.
A total of 457 British service members have died in Afghanistan since the UK's deployment. The number is a much higher death rate compared to the UK involvement in Iraq. Britain's last combat troop left Afghanistan in October 2014. Though about 700 remained in Afghanistan as part of a NATO mission to train Afghan forces. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Former members who have escaped this group describe it as a bloodthirsty cult that's involved in torture, forced sterilization, imprisonment, separating children from their parents. So should the EU not add this organization to its terrorist list?
So if the agreement is made among the member states by unanimity, then the entity, organization, or the individual is put on the either terrorist or sanctions list, and then the member states are responsible for enforcing the restrictive measures against this entity or individual.
The MKO is staging its annual conference in Paris, and previously some high-profile names from the US have been involved. The main goal of the terror group is to overthrow Iran's democratically elected government. Over the years, the MKO has killed more than 12,000 Iranian civilians and officials.
United States, they just support any group who can achieve its goals on the region. In the region, even it is the devils itself, they will support it to get to achieve the goals in the region.
MKO headquarters are in Albania. When respected international journalists attempt to access the secretive compound, they are accused of being Iranian government agents. Security experts say the terror group is mainly propped up by the US, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. Efforts by some Western countries and their regional allies to topple the Islamic Republic have been acknowledged by EU lawmakers in the past.
Europe does need to put its arm around Iran and be more welcoming.
We must work for stability in Iran and Iraq and Lebanon, a peace in Syria and Yemen, and oppose the US-Saudi attempts to isolate Iran.
Although the EU as a whole will never put the MKO on its terrorist list due to pressure from the US and others, it's well known that a number of the bloc's nations consider the organization to be a malign entity. Furthermore, because the MKO has such bizarre ideas and restrictions around human reproduction, analysts say it is simply a matter of time before the organization meets its demise. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan rule out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack again. Maybe they are going to retaliate in Osiris Dam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So this is not the solution.
Expert insists that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, no country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice, and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union, most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo, have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
As experts say, with starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
The anti-Iran Mujahideen Ekalak organization, considered by many as a dangerous terrorist organization, will hold its annual meeting in Paris on Saturday. The notorious Cairn Academic Edition House, a kind of think tank for universities, published a study about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, the umbrella organization of the MKO, with as conclusion, according to objective criteria, the NCRI is without any doubt a sectarian organization. The MKO is, among others, accused of separating children from their parents. So why do French authorities allow them to organize their annual conference?
If Mariam Rajavi is still in France and they still have their rallies every now and then in Paris, it means that the French want to be on both sides of the fence, like all the Europeans. France has an interest of having good relations with Iran. They had Total, which had invested a lot of money then, they'd probably want to go back.
In previous meetings of the MKO in Paris, the group had actively lobbied to obtain the support of mayors and members of parliament. The most visible support comes from French Member of Parliament Habib Meir, who has the double nationality, Israeli and French. He participates even in marches from the MKO here in 2016. Is there a link between Israel and the MKO terrorist organization?
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by the NBC radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
Also, important USA officials spoke at the conference. John Bolton, a former USA national security advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York, and they receive money. USA speakers receive $25,000. French speakers receive $12,500. Media reports say that the money comes from the CIA, from Mossad, but mainly from Saudi Arabia. Experts say that European Union countries, and France in particular, want to eat from both sides. They tolerate the terrorist group on their territory and seek better relations with Iran, especially for economic reasons. It's not sure that this can work. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which is now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency, but the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down, but the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled, as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the US and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Julian Assange recently turned 50 years old inside Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison in London. Despite winning his legal battle against extradition to the United States, he remains incarcerated in the UK's most notorious prison while awaiting the US government's appeal. The WikiLeaks co-founder faces 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, for conspiracy to receive, obtain and disclose classified diplomatic and military documents. But many feel that his real crime was exposing US war crimes to the world. Assange's treatment, which UN Rapporteur Niels Melzer described as psychological torture, has caused outrage back in his native country of Australia, where over 600,000 people have signed a petition calling for his immediate release.
Despite the corporate media running dead on the issue, basically, and not supporting him, there has been a groundswell and there's been a lot of campaigns. There are regular rallies, and of course, but we rely on the social media and other forms of media because the corporate media has been so locked out because they have been in lockstep with all of these 8 wars in the Middle East in the last 20 years.
This also prompted Australian MPs from across the political spectrum to issue a statement via video message to US President Joe Biden to drop the espionage charges against the Australian citizen and for the British government to allow him to return home.
Citizens expect us to protect journalists and publishers, not to imprison them for their work.
So far, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to back campaigners' call for his release and said Assange should not receive, quote, special treatment. Press TV spoke to Australian academic Tim Anderson and asked him what he thought of these comments by the Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, unfortunately, we have a long tradition in Australia of governments kowtowing to Washington, and particularly the Conservative ones. The Conservative ones have been huge enthusiasts for doing whatever Washington wants them to do. So, unfortunately, that's a tradition we live with, and it takes an extraordinary amount of pressure to shift them to lift their fingers and do something that Washington might not agree with. But nevertheless, the pressure is being raised here.
The pressure on Joe Biden's administration to drop the charges against Julian Assange is mounting, with not only Australian MPs demanding his release, but also Italian parliamentarians calling for the recognition of his political refugee status. But will any of this sway the US, who seem as determined as ever to extradite the co-founder of WikiLeaks? Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by US President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayed Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinians to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayed Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
With the Olympics weeks away, time is running out, but there are still important precautions that could be implemented to avoid a worst-case COVID-19 super-spreader scenario. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lisa M. Brusso, author. This article is published under the heading Olympics, Unanswered Questions About Serious COVID-19 Risks. Stay tuned for more. With the Olympics weeks away, time is running out, but there are still important precautions that could be implemented to avoid a worst-case COVID-19 super-spreader scenario. Yet, the International Olympics Committee, IOC, continues to give at best cavalier attention to the problem of the viral transmission. When the IOC made the decision to postpone the Olympics in March 2020, there were fewer than 350,000 COVID-19 cases in the entire world. Today, more than that number, some 370,000 are infected each day. In March 2020, COVID-19 had killed fewer than 15,000 people. Last week, COVID-19 killed at least 57,000 people, and that was the lowest weekly death toll since November 2020. Efforts to combat the pandemic remain precarious, with COVID-19 cases increasing in much of the world. The IOC has repeatedly invoked the mantra that 80% of those in Olympic Village will be vaccinated, but that will not be true of the many volunteers, workers, and spectators in poorly vaccinated Japan, nor will it be enough. Moreover, the IOC says nothing about the variability in vaccine effectiveness. Several countries that rely mainly on vaccine have experienced recent surges in infections, probably due to the ability of the highly transmissible Delta variant, which has become dominant in many countries, to evade the vaccine. Separately, a Ugandan athlete and coach tested positive for COVID-19 upon entry into Japan, both fully vaccinated. Although one would think that the IOC would be particularly sensitive to differences among sports, its risk assessments fail to distinguish among competitions. One-on-one competitions involving close conduct and conducted indoors carry a much higher risk than single competitor events. Wrestling is riskier than weightlifting. Boxing is riskier than badminton. Thomas Bach, PhD, IOC president and gold medalist in fencing, should understand that fencers have a much higher risk of spreading COVID-19 than track and field athletes. The risk of transmission increases with the number of potential sources, the quantity and closeness of contacts, and the time spent in a shared space. It also varies by the nature of different sports. At least daily testing of everyone in the medium and high-risk categories could help to decrease the chance of infectious people being present. To make this work, however, the IOC would need to include everyone in these categories, including the officials, workers, and volunteers. Instead, the IOC is doing only daily testing on athletes whom it deems at risk, without explanation of at risk. Daily testing only works if the test is specific and sensitive and if the results are variable quickly. Within a few hours, even with those caveats, testing cannot be relied upon to pick up every possible infected person in a timely manner. What the IOC recommends is based on a now superseded understanding of how COVID spreads, as if it is transmitted only by large droplets that fall to earth quickly rather than small particles that linger and spread in the air. So the IOC recommends face coverings, even though they do not limit emission or inhalation of small infectious particles. Barriers, even though they do not stop the dispersion of small infectious particles, opening a window every 30 minutes, which is hardly sufficient to lower the concentration of infectious particles in dorm or dining rooms. Notably, air conditioning is not ventilation. Making air colder and moving it around the room is not the same as exchanging new air with old. Rather, it simply distributes an increasing particle concentration throughout the space, which could ensure that everyone in that space inhales an infectious dose, as demonstrated early in the pandemic during the now infamous Guangzhou restaurant outbreak. Stadiums control both spectators and athletes by channeling them through small corridors. Tunnels and corridors, including hotel hallways, are risky places of high density but low ventilation. An urgent risk assessment and review of all environments where athletes, support staff, workers, and spectators will congregate is needed to minimize the risk of exposure. To help the IOC with the basic precautionary steps that it seems unable to take on its own, we pose the following questions. What is the response plan if there is an outbreak of COVID-19 during the Games? Why isn't daily testing being conducted on everyone with potential for close contacts using PCR-based testing? Will there be genomic testing to better understand who infected whom and to prepare countries as athletes return? What has been done to evaluate the quality of ventilation in all venues and locations throughout the Olympic Village and venues? What has been done to implement air filtration in all venues and locations throughout the Olympic Village and indoor venues in all areas where ventilation is inadequate? Are there enough resources in the Olympic Village to manage a large outbreak? How will a readily available supply of approved masks be obtained and distributed to athletes? Will workers and others required to spend lots of time in close contact with many people be provided with fit-tested respirators to ensure that they are adequately protected from an infectious dose? How is the IOC updating the Olympic Village and venues in light of the new variants, especially the Delta variant? The best case scenario: the Olympics happen safely, a cause for great global celebration. Worst case scenario, Tokyo 2020 becomes a global mega spreader event, setting a world record for pandemic acceleration. What happens in Tokyo won't stay in Tokyo. For better or worse, the Olympics will affect all of us. The IOC needs to get its corporate act together for the sake of the public and global consequences.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern here on IRIB English Radio. If I were to talk about the concept of forgiveness, how it's been defined and manifested, and how we've been instructed to practice it within Islam, I probably have to be here till Saturday morning. We're recording this on Tuesday, by the way. One of the reoccurring themes within the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and the luminous verses of the Quran is the theme and topic regarding forgiveness and all its derivatives. With that said, let's listen to a short and interesting story regarding this matter, and we're going to be right back, so stay with the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends of this program, Lantern, so welcome. We have an interesting story for today, so let's see what's the title. True Forgiveness. Yes, that's the title of today's story. True forgiveness involves forgetting, letting it go, and moving on. While I was away on a business trip once, I received a call from one of my managers who wanted to resign because of how he was being criticized by his immediate superior. I asked him to hold off. He said, "I'm resigning." He then opened up a Pandora's box of experiences, complaints and feelings, including even stronger ones from his wife. As I genuinely listened, the negative energy in his expression was dissipated, and on his own, he agreed to visit with me as soon as I returned. When I returned, he brought his wife to my office, and they were pleasant on the surface, but as soon as we began to discuss the real issues, gushed forth. I continued to listen until they felt understood, and then they became very open. I then taught them about the space between stimulus and response, and how the greatest harm is not in what people do to us, but in our response to what they do to us. So I continued listening until other issues were expressed and understood, including how these issues at work had affected their own marriage and family life. It was truly like peeling off the layers of an onion until you reach the soft inner core. More negative energy was released until they were extremely open to the whole idea that no one can do us any harm without our consent, and that our chosen response is the key determiner of our life, that we are a product of our decisions, not our conditions. They were very humbled and agreed to think about it. He later called me on the phone and said that he had come to see the wisdom of the principle. We discussed and accepted it, that he had gone to his boss and asked for forgiveness, that his boss was literally overwhelmed by this expression, that he in turn had asked his forgiveness and that it had restored their relationship. My friend said to me that he and his wife had reached such a point of accepting the space between stimulus and response and the power of choice that even if they had been rebuffed in their sincere seeking of forgiveness, he was determined to stay on and make a success of things as best he could. Yes, he who forgives you out of love takes upon himself the consequences of what you have done. What you've just listened was written by Stephen R. Covey from the book The Eighth Habit.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
One of the smallest and the simplest benefits of forgiveness, practicing forgiveness, being mindfully forgiving, is that based on the universal rule of what goes around comes around, one day, and that day will surely come, when we are in dire and crucial need of forgiveness, we will be given it. It's the law of the world. In fact, there are a kajillion ahadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam regarding forgiveness. But one that is related to what I just mentioned is from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the CEO, if not the inventor of forgiveness himself. He says, forgive the way you wish to be forgiven. Now, the way you wish to be forgiven can be in two categories: the way you wish to be forgiven by people and the way you wish to be forgiven by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And God knows we are in need of both kinds of forgiveness. We are not infallible, and even in the infallibles, we're totally cool and confident enough to ask people for forgiveness whenever the time came. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, there's a saying, a story that states when the time of his death was drawing near, he went to a public place like a marketplace or something, and everyone obviously knew him in the city of Medina, and he asked the people, "Oh people, I've lived among you for this many years. If I've wronged anyone, please come and claim your right now, because on the day of judgment, we don't want to be collecting rights on that day. We've got more important things to do." And one Arab man came up to Rasulullah and said, "One day you accidentally lashed me. I don't know, you were striking something, or you were walking with a stick or a lash or something, and it hit me accidentally, and it hurt, and you got to compensate." And Rasulullah was like, "Sure, I'm so sorry I did that. Come and take your right. You could hit me once, you know, just to get even with me." And as he lifted his shirt to the same part that man claimed to be hit, the man came and gently caressed Rasulullah and said, "No, O Messenger of Allah, you had never hit me. I was just trying to find an excuse to smell your scent one final time." The point is that Rasulullah could have said, "Oh, hell no, I didn't hit no one. How can you say that? I'm infallible. I don't make mistakes." But he was humble enough to seek forgiveness for something that he was most probably sure he never even did. But when it comes to us human beings, not only are we stingy when it comes to giving out forgiveness, giving away forgiveness to other people, but we are also stingy when it comes to obtaining it for ourselves, because we don't even bother to accept the fact that we made a mistake and that warrants an apology, that demands an apology. We won't even accept that, thus depriving ourselves of the forgiveness of a fellow human being. And I think that occurs in regard to the other category of forgiveness, which is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well. There's a hadith in Qudsi where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says to Prophet Dawood ala nabina wa alayhi salam, that, O Dawood, when my servant asks me for forgiveness for a mistake, a sin that they feel guilty and remorseful for, not only will I erase that mistake, I will forgive them as if they never made that kind of a mistake, but I will turn that mistake and error into a good deed for them, and I will put it in their book of hasanat. That's how vast and unconditional Allah's forgiveness is. And it's really sad that we would deprive ourselves from this endless and infinite resource, which we can so very easily tap into. We don't even have to utter the words Astaghfirullah Rabbi, just a thought crossing our minds that so-and-so thing that I did wasn't the best thing, and I wish God would forgive me and give me a chance to make things right. And already Allah has opened the doors of His mercy and forgiveness upon us and showered us with His compassion and love. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. As always, I thank you for being with us. And until another greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.